Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of October 27th. I'm joined this week by Jim Keane, Jesuit scholastic. Welcome, Jim.
How are you, sir?
Good. Jim is, of course, an associate editor at America, and he's been writing, along with Father Jim McDermott, a series of articles on the history of the magazine for our centennial, which is, of course, we're celebrating this year, 1909 to 2009. Now, Jim, you and Father McDermott have written now three articles about specific editors and specific times in the history of the magazine. Maybe we can kind of go through each of them. Three colorful people, very different but very interesting. The first was the founder of the magazine, Father John Wynn. Maybe you could kind of introduce him to our listeners.
Yes, thanks, Tim. John Wynn was sort of a larger-than-life figure in the church at the turn of the last century. He was the editor of the Catholic Encyclopedia. He was the postulator for the cause of the North American Martyrs. And he always had this dream of starting a weekly periodical that would not only be religious in nature, but would also cover culture, the arts, and politics, too. And so he fought for about 30 years to get America started. And finally, in 1909, he was able to get the magazine underway. And he only lasted about a year as editor, but he did set the magazine going and in some ways formulated its early editorial policies.
Yeah, that's one of the ironies of the story you tell, is that here's someone who was, you know, this was his kind of life's dream to create this magazine, and he was only here for, so, I mean, he helped get it started. You know, he was, perhaps the kind of primary force, but he didn't sound like the greatest administrator.
No, and I think that's, at any magazine, that's going to be a tension, is that the visionary is not going to be the administrator, and the financial man is not going to be the dreams guy. And I think Wynn was a visionary, he had a lot of dreams, but no, he was not a good administrator, and he couldn't really deal with money very well.
Now, what were some of the topics that, under his in his short tenure, that the magazine took up?
I think Wynn's primary interest was the relationship between Catholicism and the United States, which is reflected in the magazine's name, obviously. But other topics covered would include a strong European focus, more of a catechetical focus than the magazine might have now. The tone was a little bit more moralizing in a way. Book reviews would have focused heavily on Catholic authors, on religious and philosophical topics. But there would be a fair amount of politics and culture as well.
Now, let's talk about the name. Was America, was that his idea to call the magazine that?
It was not, as a matter of fact. He thought the name was a little too bold. It was the idea of Thomas Campbell, who was the second editor of the magazine, but who was provincial at the time they formulated it. Once they voted on it and they accepted it, Wynn became a big fan of it. He thought it was it would reflect the content of the magazine very well.
What were some of the other names that were floated?
Well, anytime you're dealing with Jesuits, someone wants to name it Loyola. Then Word and Work was another one. Truth was another one. And the Freeman was another possibility that almost got accepted. But if you go back in the history of magazines in the United States, there was another magazine called the Freeman's Journal, which was this very angry anti-Catholic journal. So they thought the name might have been a little too close.
Well, of those names you mentioned, America, I think, has kind of stood the test of time better than some of those others, which sound a little dated, you know. America, even though I think some people are still surprised, it is kind of a bold choice, but certainly we were the first ones out there, so.
Yes, and certainly there have been many other attempts to name magazines America over the years.
Now, so Campbell followed when pretty close after the founding of the magazine, and he stayed with the magazine for a while.
He was. Until 1914, he was editor, and he was responsible for putting the magazine back on a solid financial footing, maybe toning down some of the Wynn's more aggressive rhetoric in terms of the relationship between the church and the nation.
And then he was followed by Richard Tierney, who you have also written about in America.
Yes, and I really enjoyed doing a lot of that work. Jim McDermott did a lot of the research, but I was able to sort of go through it and really get a sense for this guy. And Tierney was kind of a classic Irish-American hothead. His fellow editors described him as a very intimidating person. He was a big figure on the national stage at the time. We're talking about the period of World War I, a lot of controversy over the Irish question, a lot of controversy over Mexico. And Tierney, I mean, he was not afraid of a fight. He'd wade into any sort of dispute. And he raised the profile of the magazine a lot, and in many ways was much more politically involved than I think we as editors feel comfortable with today.
And he got into some trouble, or at least from your research, it looks like there were some people keeping a close eye on the magazine's activity during that time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, in terms of national policies about magazines, there was a much less of a sense that you had real freedom of speech. There was a lot of paranoia about a secret fifth column against the United States during World War One, a much sort of closer control over what magazines could say and do at the time.
Now, you mentioned the Irish question. What were some of the other kind of pet causes that Tierney focused on in the magazine?
Well, as you know, in Mexico at the time, there were a series of coups and revolutions and counter-revolutions, a lot of which had a very strong anti-clerical bent. So priests and nuns and the church in general suffered a lot in those years. And the Jesuits have their own history with that in terms of Miguel Pro and various other historical personalities. But Tierney was basically, I mean, his main objection was that the United States government had its own interest in avoiding any mention or discussion of these topics, in part because Mexico has a lot of oil, and we were getting a lot of oil from them. And so the Wilson presidency basically denied that there was any abuse happening, that there was no persecution of the church in Mexico. And Tierney went after them pretty consistently, editorially, in the magazine, in other venues. He did some lectures at Carnegie Hall where he spoke in front of thousands of people listing some of these abuses.
Now, you mentioned Tierney and taking up this cause, and we should talk about some of the specifics of the kind of the surveillance that was done. I mean, there were times when the magazine was literally, the phones were bugged or something along those lines?
Yes, the phones were bugged. There was a rumors of a plot against Tierney's life by agents of the Mexican government. And then the United States government required America to send two copies every week to the post office general master, who that office would check it for signs of dissent or disloyalty to the government.
As far as you can tell, do you think that Tierney curtailed his coverage in any way because of these threats or because of this, or did he just continue kind of hounding this issue?
I think there's a combination of he continued hounding the issue, but at the same time he did, you know, give various apologias for the magazine, saying that it had always been loyal, it had always, you know, been in favor of America, it had always been in favor of the war effort once the war began, and in terms of other international questions, I think there was a combination there. He remained defiant, but at the same time explained the magazine's position, both in the magazine itself and in other venues, including the New York Times and other newspapers.
Now, how long was he editor for?
He was editor from 1914 to 1925. He died very young. He got very sick, and he was replaced in 1925.
1920, by the time, obviously, World War One was over by then, what were some of the concerns of the magazine in kind of the later part of his tenure?
Once you get into the 20s, the Mexican question really is the number one pressing concern. And then you also have other questions that start arising on the national scene: prohibition, migration to the cities, a strong renewed sense of isolationism on the part of the United States. The League of Nations is rejected, and the United States in some ways pulls back from the international stage.
Now we're going to fast forward a bit in a moment to the career of John Lafarge, who was an editor here and a well-known Jesuit. But maybe we can focus a little bit on, you know, there's been a lot of references in the news recently to the Great Depression. Who was the editor at that point of the magazine's history, and you know, how did the magazine do during those difficult times?
Well, the magazine has always had a sort of series of yo-yos financially, and I think that certainly in the Depression there was a lot of cost cutting in terms of the price of paper, in terms of what kind of subscribers you would have, what the numbers would be, and certainly it did affect the magazine. On the other hand, if you look at the editorial tone in those days, there is a conscious attempt to keep the readers focused on the world outside, on the international stage, on what's happening. 1933, yes, it's the height of the Great Depression, but there's also Hitler comes to power in Germany. You know, there's various other international crises that go on, monetary crises around the world, inflation, and there's a lot of focus on that, as well as a deep concern for the state of the church in the United States.
And we have to remember at this time that, you know, magazines, along with newspapers, were the principal means of conveying, you know, reporting information. You know, people couldn't get this information any other way. So it was a real service to provide this kind of, you know, especially in the on the Mexico question, where perhaps you weren't getting the full story from other media outlets.
Right, certainly. And, you know, if you look at the correspondence America had in those days, there was a real effort to find people who would give a different perspective. So G.K. Chesterton, Hilaire Belloc, Dorothy Day, you have different voices, both national and international, giving a different take on the scene.
Well, you mentioned Belloc and Chesterton and Day. I should also mention that Jim has been heading up our kind of one-pagers we've been running through the centennial year, little excerpts from the magazine's past where we've had those authors that he just mentioned, and we'll have a few more in the coming months. So we're going to move ahead to talk about the time when John Lafarge was editor here at America. Now, Lafarge came from a prominent family here in the United States.
Certainly, and the Lafarges are still artistically a very well-known family in the U.S., but his father was a famous architect. He had two other Lafarge descendants were famous architects as well. One designed the stained glass windows that are in the chapel at Harvard, the original design for St. John the Divine Episcopal Cathedral in New York. Then once you go down through history, another became a famous folk singer, and another won the Pulitzer Prize for a novel he wrote in 1929.
So when did John Lafarge decide to, he went to Harvard, correct?
Yes.
And it was after that that he decided to enter the priesthood?
Yeah, and if you read his own writings and his autobiography and some of the other materials that that Jim McDermott and I were able to find, he was sort of discontented at Harvard. The ethos of the day really focused around George Santayana and a modernist anti-religious bent to the intellectual climate, which Lafarge found very offensive, and he had a few run-ins with Santayana, as a matter of fact, which he talks about in his autobiography. And so he left. When he graduated, he did then go to Innsbruck in Austria to a diocesan seminary.
Now, the article in our October 27th issue is called The Manner is Extraordinary. Maybe you can just explain that title to our listeners.
Lafarge was very fond of the phrase that it occurs in the Jesuit Ordo, which is basically a description of how one should say Mass every day. And so if there's a feast day, that would be listed. If there were certain vestments you should wear or certain prayers you should use. But if there were none of those mandated, instead it would say the manner is ordinary. And so that was the title then that he chose for his own autobiography.
And then, of course, our title is a bit of a play on that. Here's someone who came from a prominent American family, went to Harvard. You think he would, you know, enter the Jesuits. He would have be sort of going places, be given kind of premier spots to serve. But after his ordination, he became an assistant pastor here. There is that because he had health problems, correct?
He did have health problems, and one of his superiors had a great line, which Lafarge later reported, which actually appeared in the New York Times the day after his death, which is better to be a live jackass than a dead lion. And so, yes, he did. He had to move around a lot. He wanted to go into higher ed, at various points he had to take time off work because he was never really in good health. And so he didn't get to do necessarily what he wanted, although obviously once he started doing parish work, he fell in love with it.
Yeah, that's what's interesting is that maybe he wouldn't have chosen to do this parish work, but it turned out to kind of put him in touch with the issue that he would become identified with for his whole career, which was race relations.
Right, exactly. And his first assignments in southern Maryland at these parishes where the population was mixed African-American and white, the African-American population was descended from slaves, which in many cases the Jesuits had owned. It's an episode in our history which, you know, is not often talked about. Lafarge found in his work with the African-American population a real sympathy for their plight and he became sort of a crusader to improve their situation.
So he had this experience in the parish work, and then he came to America, where kind of gave him the platform to write about it, to speak about it, and to make the issue known among Catholics. And this was in the 40s?
In the 30s.
30s?
Yeah. But he would have, it went on from the 30s until the 60s, when he stayed in America his entire life after he first came. And for a long time, he was an associate editor, writing on these issues as well as many others. Became editor-in-chief in 1944, held that job until 48. Again, like John Wynn, he is not a great administrator. He's more of a visionary. So he stepped down in 1948, went back to being an associate editor, and remained in that capacity for 15 more years.
And he was a major player. I mean, he's a name that perhaps people aren't as familiar with these days, but a major player in the civil rights movement. He was Dr. King's speech, I Have a Dream speech.
Exactly. He was on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial there, yes.
So he would his book on the subject is called, maybe you can tell our readers.
Actually, he had a number of books. The most famous is Interracial Justice, A Study of the Catholic Doctrine of Race Relations. And that book is really classic Lafarge in a sense, because it's a philosophical text. At the same time, it's a personal reflection on the situation of race relations. So he's using the Thomistic philosophy in which he was trained, as well as his own reflections on the real-life situation.
One of the points you make later in your article is that, of course, he was an older man by the time the civil rights movement really kind of got underway. He died only a few days after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. So one of the critiques that you offer is that perhaps, you know, he didn't intend it, but there was a slightly paternalistic attitude, and that maybe, maybe you can explain it for us.
Sure. No, I think that's absolutely right. Is that it strikes us these days, if you read his writings, you would find that paternalistic attitude. And Lafarge has had a number of professional biographers. There's a number of books on him, and a couple of them do bring that up, is that in some ways, it's not working with a disadvantaged population, it's working for them, which can be patronizing, I think, in a way. And Lafarge was maybe a little bit blind to that. Another, you know, problem is that a strong focus both of the nation and the church in those years was the fight against communism. And some of Lafarge's critics have suggested that his real aim in promoting interracial harmony was to keep the African-American population from going communist, basically in ways that the nation feared that we don't fear anymore today.
And again, you start your article by mentioning the sermon that was given at his funeral in 1963 about the three Johns. Maybe you can just tell that story.
Yes, Cardinal Cushing flew in to do his funeral, which surprised some people because they would have thought that Cardinal Spellman, who was Archbishop of New York, would have been the primary celebrant. But Cushing was very fond of Lafarge. And as you mentioned, Tim, 2 days earlier, the nation had buried John F. Kennedy, who had been assassinated. And just a few months earlier, John the 23rd had died after convening Vatican II. And so Cushing gave a eulogy. Technically, it was not a eulogy. You're not allowed to have a eulogy at a Jesuit funeral. But he gave a reflection after the Mass on these three Johns that the world needed and had lost. And if you read the text, it's very moving. He was obviously very devoted to Lafarge. And the nation was going through a very difficult time. I mean, everyone was still in shock over Kennedy's assassination.
Well, we should mention there are pictures of Cardinal Cushing and John Lafarge all around America House here. They were both obviously very important figures in the history of the magazine. There are stained glass windows in the Lafarge Lounge downstairs, which show the cover of his book.
Yes, and actually, Tim, there's a funny story that not a lot of people know, is that when America House, our current residence and where the offices of the magazine are, was first being purchased, the Jesuits needed about $1.5 million to buy it and renovate it. And Walter Abbott, who was himself a very famous Jesuit, edited a lot of the documents of Vatican II, was sent by the editor at the time up to Boston to ask Cardinal Cushing for a donation. And they were going to ask for $500,000, expecting to get $25,000. And Abbott went up there and he asked him, he said, you know, we're asking for money for this new building. And Cushing raised his hand and said, how much do you need? And he said, $500,000. Cushing said, fine. And he wrote him a check for $500,000 and told him that the reason why he was willing to give that much was his esteem for John Lafarge and the work Lafarge had done over the decades.
And that continues to be a great support to the magazine, and the fact that we have this house and it, you know, not only can support the magazine but many other Jesuits who live here. So there is and it continues to be a real legacy of both Lafarge and Cardinal Cushing. Now maybe we can end by just talking about what you have in store for the rest of the centennial year. You know, what are the projects you have underway?
Well, we'll continue to do the one-page historical retrospectives, pulling articles from the magazine's past. Sometimes we have to edit those down because they're a little long, but giving the readers once a month a chance to see something from our 100-year history. Then we also have a few more articles on the magazine's history. There are a few more colorful characters. Bob Hartnett was another editor in the 50s who really clashed with John McCarthy and with the John Birch Society and became sort of a public figure for a time. And then, obviously, there are other issues the magazine has taken up over the years, which I think the readers will find interesting if we can give those some coverage.
Good. Well, we look forward to those articles and want to thank Jim Keane again for coming in. And hopefully we can have you back again soon, maybe to talk about the next article.
Thank you, Tim.
I want to thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. Tune in next week when we'll have a clip from the archives, an interview we did with Father John O'Malley. He has a new book out about Vatican II, so he talked about that with us on his last visit, so we'll have that for you. And a reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.